This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm Kathleen Harris. We're really happy to have you join us this week.
It's been only a few weeks since you filed your income taxes, so the topic of income has probably been on your mind. For those of us who aren't retired, most of our income is from, let's say, a salary paid by our employer. Now, there's not a whole lot we can do to change the amount our employer pays us. But for those of us who are retired, some of our income might come from, let's say, Social Security or pensions, which we can't really change that either. Once we've made an election as to how to receive our benefits, but there are other sources of income that we do have some control, and that's what we're going to be talking about in today's session.
And in the second half of today's program, Jim and his guest, estate attorney Roberta Robinson, are going to talk about what I'm going to call inadvertent gifting. What is inadvertent gifting? Well, maybe you register one of your kids as a joint owner on your checking account or your savings account because you want someone to be able to take care of bills if you get in the hospital or can't take care of yourself anymore. But what happens when you register that kid as a joint owner? Do you actually end up, in the eyes of the law and the IRS, gifting that money to your kid? Well, maybe. So stay tuned because Jim and Roberta Robinson will be talking about that in the second half of our program today.
Now, let's talk about the focus of the first part of today's program, which is going to be on income ideas or figuring out probably the best way to make your money pay you. Now, think about that. Pay you instead of you paying somebody else. When you're thinking about have your money make money for you, you always need to identify and determine if you're comfortable with the investment risk factors. Let's talk about a few of them. Well, one, there's liquidity risk. If you go out and buy a rental property, it's not liquid. If you need to dump it, you need money. You can't just press a button and sell it like you can a stock. So you have liquidity risk. There's also something that I think is being ignored in today's environment of financial repression, which is called inflation risk, meaning that the dollars you have in savings are losing their purchasing power. Think of anything that you bought today and think of what you paid for that item or could have paid for that item 10 years ago. Then also, the one that people focus on is investment risk, the loss of value of what you paid for it. It could lose its value. You have interest rate risk, the likelihood that the investment will be affected by changes in interest rates. Take a look at what's happened to, let's say, mortgages over the last year, and take a look at what's happened to long-term treasuries. They went from a low of 1.4% in the summer of 2012. Today, they're over 2%. That means if you were invested in bonds at that rate, you're down on your money. There's currency risk, the change of value of your investment compared to other currencies around the world. What happens if the dollar goes down? You're traveling. You're going overseas. Those vacations become more expensive. Or you're in a business that has to buy, let's say, raw materials for overseas. Dollar goes down. Your input costs go up. There's political risk. Take a look at what's going on in the Ukraine or in the Middle East. And of course, there's credit risk, which is the likelihood of an investment going bankrupt. You own a bond and the company that issued the bond or even a sovereign country goes bankrupt or defaults on that bond or renegotiates it like Greece did back in 2011. So I just mentioned a number of risks from liquidity all the way to credit risk. And the thing that you have to ask yourself, there is no investment that is risk-free. Let me get that out there and repeat that. There is no risk-free investment. Even money at the bank is subject to risk. It's subject to purchasing power risk. It's subject to credit risk. Think of the people that had CDs at IndyMac and how long it took them to get their money from FDIC. So there are all kinds of risk out there. You have to ask yourself, which risk are you most comfortable with?
And when you're thinking about addressing these ideas of risk, Jim, you know, you mentioned that you have to figure out which risk you can best live with. Which ones are you still going to be able to sleep at night, knowing that those are the risks affecting your investment? And I think the other thing is too, Jim, is to really know who you are as an investor and what levels and types of risk are really suitable for someone in your situation. I know when we talk with potential investors, Jim, we're often looking at things like their age. Now, generally speaking, the rule of thumb is that people who are younger can afford to take more risk with their investments if they're willing to, because they have more time to make up loss if that happens in their portfolios. Whereas, again, the rule of thumb is that people who are in the latter part of their lives shouldn't be taking as much risk because there's less time to make up for losses. But again, all those are individual. You may be a young person with a very low tolerance for risk, and so that's going to completely change the types of investments that are attractive to you. Another thing to keep in mind when you're thinking about which investments to place money in terms of risk is, what are your goals for the money? And what is your timeline for that goal? That's going to really affect the type of investment you place it in and also the timeline of when you move the money to cash to prepare for paying for that goal. The other thing is, what are your overall financial obligations? Now, today, Jim and I are talking about income streams, but also for people who maybe aren't in a place where they need an income stream from their investments, risk still applies when you think about how that risk to that money is going to affect your overall financial health as a family or as an individual. And then the last thing is, really take a look at how any investment fits in to your overall financial picture. What are your other financial resources? What do they look like? How much do you have? How liquid or illiquid are your other investments? Is there a hole or something missing in your existing portfolio? So just keep these ideas in mind as we discuss various income ideas. Now, again, just to repeat, as Jim just said, there's no risk-free investment. And by the same token, there's no one investment idea that's suitable for everybody or that's suitable to put all your portfolio in. You really need to consult with an investment professional when you're thinking about deciding how to invest for income for your unique situation. So Jim and I are sharing these ideas with you for your information and education only, but you need to be the person that decides, with the help of a professional, which of these ideas might make sense for you and your own personal financial situation.
I want to start out where most Americans are keeping their money today, and that's in cash. Now, of course, there's two places to keep cash. You could be in a money market fund, or you can have, let's say, CDs at a bank. Now, money market funds are great. They're liquid. They don't pay you much today. After fees and everything, you're probably earning close to zero. Those interest rates fluctuate, obviously, with where interest rates are going. And unfortunately, right now, short-term rates are the lowest they've been in almost a century. But they're liquid. So if you need the money, you can get it. And unfortunately, though, with today's low interest rate environment, you're really not making a return that can compensate you for keeping your money there. You're not keeping up with inflation. And as you know, money market funds are not insured. So let's go to the safer side of the cash. And that would be things like CDs at a bank. Well, they're liquid. If you lock in a CD, you have a predictable interest rate. You know what they're going to pay you. There is some withdrawal penalties. If you invest in a six-month CD, you need the money before 6 months comes due. Well, the bank's going to charge you a withdrawal penalty. And there's a low risk of loss of principal because generally CDs are insured by FDIC, depending on the amount. And also, you have to remember this too. The higher rates offered by some banks, boy, I remember this one in the S&L crisis in the 80s where brokers were selling CDs, high CD rates, and high-risk banks were trying to generate a lot of inflows into the bank, so they were offering higher rates of return. And as we know with the S&L crisis, a lot of those banks and S&Ls went under. So remember, the higher rate of return, the riskier the bank.
I've been noticing, Jim, that there are some other flavors of CDs that are a little bit more jazzy than what we've just talked about. But I think most people listening to the program, if they are offered a CD at a bank, are probably going to be offered this very traditional version of a CD. When you're thinking about getting a fixed payout from an investment, CDs are definitely one option. Another option that Jim and I have talked about quite a bit are some form of bond investment. Now, if you're doing bonds, there's a couple different ways to invest in bonds. The first way is to do individual bonds, which is something that Jim and I talk about a lot. We usually talk about doing a laddered bond portfolio. And I've had a lot of you ask me, Kathleen, what does that really mean, a laddered bond portfolio? When you think about a ladder has rungs. And so the rungs, as you move up the ladder, get higher and higher. Now imagine that you have a portfolio of CDs with different maturity dates. Maybe you have one that matures in 6 months, one that matures in a year, one that matures in 3 years or 5 years or 10 years. So you've created essentially a portfolio for yourself of laddered maturity dates that get longer and longer the farther out you go into your investment portfolio ladder. Now, individual bonds generally offer a fixed interest rate, although there are some products that do offer variable rates that are tied to maybe inflation or LIBOR or a few other different things. But for most people, they're going to be investing in bonds that have fixed interest rates. What this means is that you have a very predictable source of income. Now, there is some risk to principal. You know, bonds, once you've purchased a bond, it does fluctuate in terms of value in the marketplace. If you hold a maturity, you will get par value back, but there is some fluctuation in market value in the meantime. There's also risk in terms of currency risk, because most of the bond product that most of us will be holding will be denominated in dollars. So just another thing to keep in mind, though, is that one of the benefits of certain types of bond investments when it comes to overall income levels is that some bonds are tax-free, which for some folks can mean a significant difference in terms of their tax bill at the end of the year. And again, just like Jim was saying about CDs, typically lower quality bonds or bonds issued by companies or municipalities or states that are having more financial trouble or that are less financially healthy typically offer you higher rates than more quality bonds do. So again, looking for the highest paying bond may seem like a good idea on the face of it, but again, keep in mind, you're taking on more risk when you do that. So individual bonds is one way to invest in bonds. Other ways to invest in bonds include investing in either a bond mutual fund or a bond exchange traded fund, a bond ETF. Now, the good news is with these types of investments is that they're pretty liquid. It's pretty easy to go into your account online or call your broker and liquidate your holding in that bond mutual fund or bond ETF. Now, the downside of that is that the underlying principal you invest in that bond mutual fund or bond ETF is constantly going up and down. So you don't have any sort of guarantee on the principal that you put in these bond ETFs and mutual funds, which is why Jim and I have talked a lot about doing laddered bonds right now as opposed to doing bond ETFs and bond mutual funds, is because the bond ETFs and bond mutual funds don't really offer you a chance to sort of offer any sort of guarantee of principal. The other thing to keep in mind too with these bond ETFs and bond mutual funds is that your overall payout rate from these bond ETFs and bond mutual funds is going to fluctuate up and down depending on the underlying product in those investments. And the payout is also going to be affected by any management fees and expenses paid on those. So again, looking at some fixed income ideas, you can do laddered bonds, bond ETFs, or bond mutual funds.
I want to move into something that you've heard us talk about here on the program, and that's annuities, and especially what we call an immediate annuity, where you give the insurance company amount of money, and depending on whether it's your life or joint life between you and your spouse, they are going to pay you immediate monthly check. It's almost like setting up your pension plan. And where these fit into is when individuals don't have enough assets, and especially in today's low interest rate environment, or they have the means or the income coming in. So immediate annuities may play a role there. Another type of annuity is a deferred annuity, and that is you put money in, and you can be invested in a fixed income or mutual funds or stocks. And while it's being deferred, meaning you're not withdrawing it, it's any taxation of any gains are deferred until the time you start to withdraw. Now, there is an issue age that you have to deal with. The insurance companies, since annuities have a guaranteed feature to them, are issued up to a certain age limit. And taxation depends on the type of contract that you set up, whether it's qualified or non-qualified. But the one thing it can give you, that something, it's almost like equivalent to a fixed income portfolio where you have a guaranteed income stream that could be partially sheltered in retirement. And they're used, for example, if you work for, let's say, the federal government, state government, especially state municipalities, where they guarantee a certain percentage of your salary at retirement. Now, what the state or municipality has been doing, you've been contributing to the program like a 403b plan or some kind of pension program. Then what happens at your retirement, they take that money, they give it to an insurance company based on your age, and that insurance company is going to give you a fixed amount of income on your life or that of your life and your spouse. So the important thing about annuities, like a fixed income bond portfolio, they can give you some predictable income that'll never change and some tax benefits to boot.
I think too, Jim, when people are looking at sources of income, we've talked about some predictable sources of income, some variable sources of income. Something we haven't talked about yet, though, is in a type of investment where you have the potential to have not only your income stream grow, but your principal grow as well. And I know that you and I have talked quite a bit about dividend paying stocks on this program. And one of the things we like about dividend paying stocks is that dividends are taxed at a different rate than ordinary income. Your taxation on dividends can range anywhere from 0 to 20% depending on your marginal tax bracket. But the plus side of doing an investment in, let's say, a portfolio of different individual dividend paying stocks is that you do have the chance that those stocks may depreciate in value. I'm not going to sugarcoat that one. Yes, there's always a risk of loss when you're investing in stocks, obviously. But there's also a possibility for gain, not only in the underlying value of those stocks, but if you're choosing really high quality companies that are paying out a dividend, and those companies have a history of increasing their dividend payouts over time, you have the chance to increase your income stream. So again, this is a way of getting more control over the type of payout you're getting from your investments. You can also invest in dividend paying equity funds or mutual funds, exchange traded funds. These are usually called equity income funds if you're looking for them in terms of a mutual fund or an ETF. Now, just like a portfolio of individual dividend paying stocks, there's risk to principal, but you have that same opportunity for a growing income stream and the same opportunity for the potential growth of the underlying investment as well as potential loss. The one thing you don't have control over, though, is because you're not controlling the underlying investments in that mutual fund or that ETF, you really don't have much control over the dividend payout. But again, it's an interesting idea for people who are looking for a way to not only grow their income stream, but have the potential to grow their underlying asset base as well.
Now, I want to turn our attention to something that we covered on last weekend's Big Picture Real Estate. And people have seen the real estate market turn around. So the question is, what about individual properties, rental income? As you know, real estate is a hands-on investment. You have tenant problems, problems with the property itself, so you have some hassles there. Another form of investing in real estate, one I like right now, is real estate investment trusts because they're publicly traded, they're liquid. If we go through another downturn and I want to get out of real estate, well, if I own an individual property, I'm going to have to put it on the market, hire a real estate agent to try to sell it, and that may take time. It's not immediately liquid. In contrast, a real estate investment trust is liquid, and not only that, 90% of the profits are paid directly to the investors as a dividend, so there's no taxation at the REIT level. And then the other thing that you might want to consider if you're maybe shorter term and you have the acumen to find pockets of real estate that are undervalued is you can buy an undervalued real estate. A lot of people did in the last couple of years when the prices were soft. You turn around, fix them up, sell them, and you flip them. So it's not a long-term investment, but it's another way of earning income.
I was going to say, Jim, I think flipping is kind of not really a source of income per se. It's kind of more of a short-term growth strategy, maybe not appropriate for someone who's looking for a steady income stream. And I was also thinking, too, that there are some REIT products out there, some real estate investment trusts that aren't publicly traded. And I've seen certain clients pursue these on their own and get into situations where their principal is tied up for years. And there's a year and a half to 2 year wait time to get their investment liquidated. So if you're thinking about doing a non-publicly traded REIT, make sure you really understand what the liquidity time horizons look like. Now, another type of investment that may or may not be very liquid is different types of limited partnerships that are holding assets that produce income. I often hear about people who have oil and gas limited partnerships they're invested in, or maybe they're invested in some kind of hedge fund that's structured as a limited partnership that invests in properties that produce income or other types of investments that produce income. Most limited partnerships are not publicly traded. And again, you get into this issue of liquidity. What happens if you need the money in a hurry? How hard is it to get it pulled out of that limited partnership and put into your pocket? So that's a very big consideration when you're thinking about investing in most limited partnerships. Now, one of the exceptions to this rule is the master limited partnership. Master limited partnerships are more liquid because they are publicly traded. They tend to invest in real estate or natural resources or commodities. And so that means that although you're getting a nice flow of income stream from those particular types of investments, you're also investing in something that's highly sensitive to movements in the metals market or the energy market. And as most of you out there listening know, those are two very, very volatile areas in the market. So if you're someone who's looking for income, master limited partnerships may pop up on your radar screen, but you have to really ask yourself, can I handle the underlying risk to my principal? I think the other thing too is that these can have a nice tax benefit, Jim, because they are usually classified, the dividends payouts to the investors are usually classified as a tax-free return of capital. So it can be something to think about for people who are bumping against those higher tax brackets.
I want to move on to something that you'll hear me speak with Kurt Wolf if you're on the Premium Channel, who analyzes the energy sector, and that's royalty trust. You mainly see these, let's say, on the U.S. and the Canadian Stock Exchange. They tend to be resource companies. They pay a higher dividend stream because that dividend is passed through directly to you, and they can be more volatile, especially if they're tied to mining and energy. I mean, take a look at, in the last year, they've been pretty steady because we've fluctuated in a narrow price range when it comes to oil. The natural gas has been a little bit more volatile, especially this winter, where we saw during the winter polar vortex, we saw natural gas prices flip from $4 all the way up to $6.50. I don't need to remind you, if you're on the East Coast, what you were paying for energy. But 90% of the profits are distributed to you as a dividend. You see rates going from 6, 8, 9, 10%. They are sensitive to interest rate changes in legislation. A good example was Canadian Royalty Trust were affected by tax law changes in legislation that went into effect in 2011. So here's another idea, and we've been giving you a number of these ideas to put together because, like I said, there is no such thing as a risk-free investment. And it may not be one investment choice that's going to put everything together for you, which is another reason we've talked about so many ideas here, because what you want, ideally, is a diversified portfolio.
I was going to say, before we close up our discussion of different income ideas, I'm just going to toss this out there. Now, not many people out there should really be considering doing this, but it might be something if you're maybe a higher net worth investor that you have a lot of other liquid assets and you can afford to tie up some of your principal in some of these situations. We do have a number of clients who have started to do some private loans. Maybe they've loaned money to a family member or to a business or to some sort of venture, which can be a way of getting a steady income check from the interest rate payments on these particular types of investments. But like I said, they're typically only suitable for people who have a higher net worth, have a lot of other really liquid assets, and you have to be really sensitive to the fact that you're taking on a really big default and credit risk when you're self-financing some of these loans. But we do have clients who earn a pretty nice income from making these loans, mostly to businesses and to ventures.
I want to move on and sort of try to pull all of what we've been talking about in terms of income in a case study, and we're going to call this Peter and Marilyn Reed. Peter worked for a big construction company, and the boom in housing in the last decade, last several years of his career, he was very busy, but it made him ready for retirement. Unfortunately, the bust happened right as he was retiring, as happened to many Americans. His wife, Marilyn, on the other hand, was a homemaker. And then as the kids grew up, moved into retail sales, a jewelry boutique, minimum income. It was more sort of something to do, kind of fun, get out. Early 70s for both of them, Peter retiring during the financial crisis in 2008, he rolled his 401k into a rollover IRA. However, the IRA was invested in stocks. And then when the downturn came, he put that IRA into cash, waiting for stable markets. Unfortunately, they were having to live off Social Security in savings, as many Americans have. I mean, I can't pick up a financial planning publication or a Wall Street Journal or something having to do with retirement planning, talking about more and more Americans are dipping into principal and savings, especially in this low interest rate environment and after two bear markets in the last decade.
Well, Jim, as you and I have mentioned several times, we often get calls from people who are in the same shoes as Peter and Marilyn Reed. You know, people who've just been really scared and really worried about their investments and really leery of taking any market risk because of what happened not only in 08, but also in the tech bubble before that. You know, we're dealing with two big psychological blows to people's faith in the market. And so it's not uncommon to see people sort of deciding to exit the markets and stay on the sidelines in cash. The trouble is that they stay there for a long time. You know, Peter and Marilyn are kind of a classic example of investors who view cash as a safe investment, as a safe haven to wait for the storms and the markets to blow over. You know, you and I have been talking about an article that just recently got published in MarketWatch by Chuck Jaffe about investors doubling down on bad ideas. And this is kind of where Chuck talks about this sort of wrong idea of the fact that investors who are staying in cash think that somehow they're avoiding risk. And they may be avoiding stock market risk, but they're really exposing themselves to other types of risk. You know, we've talked about inflation risk. There's also longevity risk, especially if you start dipping into your principal. There's dollar risk. All these are things that are risks for cash. Because cash is not really a sideline per se. When you think about cash, cash is an asset class. It is an investment. If you are keeping your money all in cash, you're violating one of the cardinal rules of investing, which is to not put all your eggs in one basket. Because again, cash is an investment. Now, I'm just going to give you an example with Peter and Marilyn so you can get a feel for what happens when you use cash as your primary investment vehicle. Now, when Peter retired, he and Marilyn had about $1.25 million, which for most of us, we'd say, yeah, that's a pretty decent nest egg. I could totally retire on that. Now, they invested all this money in CDs at a bank at 2% because, again, they were really leery of taking any risk in the market, didn't want to see their principal destroyed. So they decided to go ahead and just do a series of laddered CDs at the bank. 2% was sort of their average return on those CDs. Now, that meant that these CDs the first year generated around $30,000 for them. Peter was also drawing Social Security at around $20,000. Now their spend rate was $90,000, which meant that they had a $40,000 shortfall every year. Now where was that $40,000 coming from? It was coming from their principal. Now the problem is that after the first year of investing and following this CD investment situation with their investments, their principal was down to $1.2 million. And then the next year, down to $1.15 million. Now, the time they came to us, which was only 6 years after retirement, their principal was now less than $1 million. So in the first 5-6 years of their retirement, they'd blown through $250,000. And they came to us because they were seeing the writing on the wall and realizing, wow, if we keep investing and spending this way, we're going to run out of money before we run out of lifetime. And so they came to us looking for a solution to what can they do to tweak their situation that would allow them to be able to not only live with enough money through the remainder of their lifetime, but maybe have a little left over for their kids too.
And one of the things that Chuck Jaffe talked about this in his Wall Street Journal, CBS Market Watch, is longevity. And we all know what inflation risk is, and that is the erosion of the purchasing power of your money. But another risk that a lot of boomers are facing today with medical advances is longevity risk. In the case of Peter and his wife, their families lived into their early 90s. In this scenario, if they continued to draw on their principal, it would only take them into their late 80s. Imagine waking up and what you begin to think of as they came in to see us. After 6 years burning through over $250,000 of principal, it gets quite scary. So the scenario places you in a very vulnerable position, especially now as the government tries to unload a lot of the burdens of healthcare onto you. And think of unanticipated expenses. What if one of you gets Alzheimer's or gets incapacitated in any way? And then what about if you have kids that you want to leave a legacy to? How are you going to do that if you're burning through your principal? So what we had to do is come up with a combination of investments. It's one of the reasons why we gave you a wide spectrum of things you could do on income on today's program. So we placed dollars and investments in a couple areas. We had to grow some principal because we wanted to combat inflation, and we also needed more income so we wouldn't have to keep dipping into principal.
I just want to jump in here really fast again about this whole idea of combating inflation. When Peter and Marilyn first retired, their overall cost of living was $90,000. By the time they came into us 6 years later, their cost of living was up to over $106,000, almost $107,000. That's how much inflation can affect your purchasing power.
Going back to their situation, we wanted to achieve three things. We wanted to grow the principal to take care of inflation. We also wanted to provide more income. Now, we discussed annuity, but it really wasn't a good solution for them given their desire. They wanted to leave a legacy to their kids. When you do an immediate annuity, the insurance company is going to guarantee that income to you and your spouse as long as you live or for a period certain. But after that period, let's say after 10 years or when you're both gone, there is no money. The annuity expires. So in this case, they wanted to leave a legacy to their children. So both Peter and Marilyn, with a couple kids, said, you know, we want to leave our kids something to help start them out because times are tougher, things are more expensive today. So we nixed the annuity idea. The other thing that we had to deal with is their risk tolerance wasn't very high. Ideally, heavier weight towards stocks was just not a reality here, given their risk tolerance. So what we ended up doing is we did 70% of their portfolio in laddered bonds, averaging a little over 3%, and then 30% in dividend-paying stocks with an average of 2.5%. That was the inflation kicker. We knew that income would increase with these stocks. These were big blue-chip stocks, household names. Now, what was the benefit? Number one, overall income went up enough. Two, the bond ladder provided the opportunity to move into bonds with different interest rates as bonds mature, and especially if interest rates continue to go up. And then the other benefit was the portion of assets and dividend payers, while perhaps open to, let's say, stock market fluctuations, but it also offered the opportunity for growth of principal, and more importantly, for both Peter and Marilyn, growth of income.
Again, Jim and I have shared with you a very specific case study. Your situation may be completely different, completely new to who you are. And so Jim and I have shared a number of income producing ideas with you. But remember, whenever you're thinking about having your money make money for you, you've got to identify and determine if you're comfortable with the investment's risk factors, and you'll need to consult with an investment professional to see which of these ideas are suitable for your age, your risk tolerance, your financial situation, and your overall asset makeup.
Well, that concludes this portion of the program. Coming up next, over probably the last year, Kath and I have discussed various types of gifting. We've talked about charitable gifting, gifting to families, friends, also how to handle gift tax filings and gift tax exemptions, what the rules were. What we're going to talk about today are what we call intentional gifts. But did you know there may be some things you are doing right now with your money and your assets, maybe for the sake of convenience, or let's say a backup plan in case something happens to you, you may not realize that you may be making a gift or triggering a taxable event that you didn't intend. Joining me in the next part of the program, estate attorney Roberta Robinson and I are going to talk about inadvertently giving, as well as other ways to address the reason why people register assets jointly with family members. We're going to talk about the pitfalls of this coming up right after this. When it comes to estate planning, you may not think of it, but the way you hold title to property, joint tenancy, tenants in common, community property, can make a difference when it comes to taxation. Joining me on the program is Roberta Robinson. And Roberta, when you buy a piece of property, let's say you're buying a home or you're filling out a brokerage account as a couple, there's a little check mark there and there's a box and it says, how do you want to hold title to it? And a lot of people don't pay much attention to that. typically they take title as joint tenancy, as many couples do. Let's talk about what property titling doesn't do. It's cause for a lot of mistakes, as you well know, that are made in estate planning. So let's begin with the different types like joint tenancy, tenants in common, community property, and then let's talk about the mistakes that can be made.
So how you hold title often dictates who will inherit. This comes as a surprise to people. They think if they've set in their will or their trust what their distribution plan is, that that controls all their assets. But in fact, the way you hold title can override your estate plan or work with your estate plan. Joint tenancy is a way to hold title that does override your estate plan. Joint tenancy states that on the death of a joint tenant, that asset automatically, by operation of law, belongs to the surviving joint tenant or joint tenants. So if I have a will that says everything goes to my son, but I hold an asset in joint tenancy with my daughter, that asset will go to my daughter, not under my will, to my son. So it's very important to know that joint tenancy overrides your estate plan. Tenants in common works with your estate plan. Oftentimes, partners are tenants in common. Maybe they own a commercial building together or a rental property. If you are a tenant in common, your will controls where your share of the tenancy goes. And if you have a trust to avoid probate, you want to make sure to transfer your tenancy in common interest to your trust, and your trust would then be a tenant in common with the other owner. That's a lot of words, but that's the concept. Here in California, we have a very unique way of holding title, which is as community property or community property with right of survivorship. Community property is making the statement that I own this with my spouse 50-50. In a way, it's like a tenancy in common. If it says with right of survivorship, then it automatically goes to that survivor at death and overrides the estate plan.
You just brought up a couple of key things, Roberta. So let's say that in my estate plan, I say that upon my demise, my assets are to go to my sons. That's what my estate plan and trust says. It goes to my sons. But let's say that I bought a piece of property and I put it in joint tenancy with my daughter. I don't have a daughter, but let's throw that into the equation. What you're saying there is property titling takes precedent over what you put in your will or what you put in your trust. And I think this is something people forget. They think, oh, I've got a will that says it goes this way, but they hold title in a different way, and property titling is where the property is going to.
That's correct. And if I can get on my bandwagon, a big area where this is a problem is in retirement plans and life insurance. People will come to me and say how they want their will and their trust to read, and we get it all ready, and then I nag them that they have to get copies of their beneficiary designations on retirement plans and life insurance, because those beneficiary designations override the will and the trust. And we need to make sure that it's all working together. And I tell people, as important as these papers that I'm filling out for you and preparing are, you need to make that phone call and get your beneficiary designation. And sometimes people just, you know, hem and haw, oh, it's too much trouble. And I say, that phone call could be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Make that phone call.
And let's talk about some of the problems. Let's say that husband and wife own property. Let's say it was originally in joint tenancy. I'll pick on the husband. The husband passes away. So as a surviving joint tenant, the property goes to the, let's say, surviving wife. She, on the other hand, wants to simplify her estate plan. She now puts her daughter on the title of the property. Let's talk about the gift tax consequences, problems with creditors, problems in divorce, all the issues that are created once that additional child or that child is put on the property with, let's say, the surviving spouse.
We've had some examples of this that have happened in our office, and I'll give you a story. I had a surviving spouse who added on her daughter. It actually was her daughter. And she wanted to do that. It was a simple thing to do. It just required a deed to add her daughter on, and that was recorded. Years and years later, she and her daughter had a falling out, and she wanted that property back. The client wanted the property back in her own name and was not going to leave it to her daughter. They had really had it with each other. So I said, well, you can't do this by yourself. Your daughter has to sign off on the deed. And can we get her signature? Well, we didn't know. We sent the deed out to the daughter, and the daughter turned out to be fair and called and came in and signed the deed, and it was recorded, even though the daughter knew she would never see that property again. So that had a happy ending, but in many cases, a child with whom you've, you know, had a falling out or who may be under the influence of their spouse will not deed it back to the parent. Another kind of operating problem is if you need to get a mortgage or a reverse mortgage on the property. If a child is a co-owner, mortgaging the property will require the child's signature. And if you have a child who has creditor problems, and sometimes this comes up that a child has not paid outstanding tax bills, and we find out later that they've got a problem with the IRS or the tax authorities. If there's a creditor out there, the child's creditor, as soon as they see that there's a house with the child's name on it, could try to attach the house or record a lien against the house. So this isn't your debt, this is your child's debt, and now you're exposed to their financial problems. Another thing that could come up is that the child gets a divorce, and now their divorcing spouse is saying that this property is community property of their marriage just because the child's name is on the property. And this happens. And it could be that the divorcing spouse knows it doesn't really belong to the child. The child's name is just on there for convenience. But the divorcing spouse wants as much leverage as they can possibly get and is really making trouble by claiming that this is community property, really trying to get some sort of a settlement. So there are these problems. I'll go on. When you add a child, the question is, have you really made a gift to the child when you add them on as a joint tenant? Arguably, you've given them a 50% interest and perhaps should be filing a gift tax return. In most cases, the parent is adding the child just for convenience, really is not sharing any possession or ownership with the child. The parent really has retained all that possession. So as an estate attorney, we often say it's not a completed gift because the parent really has retained control and possession, and we're not too concerned about filing a gift tax return.
Roberta, can I stop you there for a minute? I want to bring something up. Let's take Larry Lots of Bucks, and he has, let's say, a commercial office building, and let's just put a number on it, and let's say it's worth $1 million. He puts it in joint tenancy with his son. Let's say the son works with him or something. He doesn't file a gift tax return because theoretically, half that building now, which is worth $1 million, half of it, since it's in joint tenancy, $500,000 is technically the son's. How does the IRS pick this up, and what are the consequences? Are there penalties? Do you have to file a back gift tax return? I mean, most people don't realize when they do these things, they're making gifts, and Uncle Sam, your favorite uncle, wants to know about those gifts, and there's not only reporting requirements, but there could be some tax consequences, depending on the size of the gift.
Well, on the commercial building, the question would be, who's reporting the rental income? If they're sharing the rental income and deductions, it certainly looks like dad made a gift of half to the son. On the other hand, if dad is retaining all the income, all the deductions, he's really just added his son on for convenience only. And the law says that if you transfer something but retain the right to possession or income or the use of that property 100%, that really it's not a completed gift. In the event of dad's death, if that entire property shows up on dad's return and he's been reporting all the income and all the deductions 100% all the time, I think it'll sail through that there was never really a completed gift to the son. How it can backfire, it should never happen, but what if the son dies first? The government says whichever joint tenant dies first, 100% of that property must be reported on their return. So 100% of the commercial building would show up on the son's return. And then the father has to prove that he was the source of funds. He was really the 100% owner. He contributed 100%. The son didn't own anything. And that would be an uphill battle, you might say, to prove that. And that's the real hot water, is if that younger generation person dies first.
You know, one thing that we know is tax laws change over time. The economy, the financial markets change over time. Bull markets, bear markets. And a lot of times you see these gifts being made, or let's say the convenience of putting something in joint tenancy with the child. And you're not thinking at the time that, number one, you could have a falling out in the case that you talked about in your practice with the client. Two, that child ends up getting divorced. Three, they end up having creditor problems. Let's throw out another one. That child gets in a car accident, injures somebody, and gets sued. These are things you're not thinking of at the time you're making the gift. You're thinking of convenience. Hey, this is an easy way to do this. You're not thinking about all these things that could surface years later.
Right. The risk that you're taking really to just avoid probate isn't worth it at all, because there are many ways to avoid probate. And of course, the living trust or revocable trust is the thorough way that avoids probate on everything. It just isn't that much of an investment in terms of time or attorney's fee compared to the risk you're taking on of possibly losing the investment.
You know, something that I have heard, and of course, Roberta, you and I live in California, where our definition of a millionaire is almost a homeowner. Take a look at housing prices here. But elsewhere around the country, there is less of an emphasis on living trusts for avoidance of probate, for estate taxes, for continuity purposes, for asset protection, incapacity issues. There are a number of reasons that come into play. I have found that outside of California, and especially in other states, that practicing attorneys don't use trust as much as they do, let's say, in a state of California. Can you explain that? Is it because of the high price of assets here, because we're more developed, because the probate process is more expensive? I have found a reluctance in other states by practicing attorneys to use living trusts.
It's interesting. It goes back a long time ago. This is just my little summary of what I think might have happened. A long time ago, professionals were not allowed to advertise. It was considered to be unprofessional. And the law was changed in California in the late 70s that professionals could advertise. And that would be attorneys, it could be dentists, all kinds of professionals. And then you saw this huge amount of advertising that started, a lot of what we call the living trust campaigns, lots of media attention to trusts, and of course the idea that you can be your own trustee, you don't have to hire a professional trustee or use an outside bank department. And I think in California, where maybe media is king, there was so much advertising during that period of time that it became widely known and widely used in the state of California. And I don't know if that advertising wave occurred in other states. Also, we have a large amount of wealth in California compared to other states. And in the states that do have wealthier residents, you see a lot of trusts. So that can be Connecticut, New York, out here. And that's my idea of why is it different here?
Yeah, because it's amazing, you would think. And some of these other states have estate taxes as well. You know, we all know about the federal government taking its take, but several states as a sources of revenue do have estate taxes as well.
That's right. And even if you are in California, if you own real estate in another state, and we do have a lot of people who retire out here and have real estate in another state, the other state controls whether there's an estate tax at the death of the California resident. So I've had a client here who has inherited a lot of farmland in Illinois, and I say, you have to talk to your Illinois attorney about the Illinois estate tax and what can you do in the state of Illinois to prevent that tax, and likewise in New York.
Let me get your opinion on this. A couple of years ago, until 2013, where they actually clarified estate tax rates, it was sort of, we were in this phase in the last decade where they were raising the exemption. Then we had, what was it, Roberta? The year 2010 was a year. If you died, there were no estate taxes. And then it was supposed to revert back. And there was a lot of uncertainty when it came to estate taxation because we didn't know what the laws were going to be. They settled that last year. We know that there's a 45% tax rate. The exemption is $5.25 million. So a couple with a living trust today could double that to, let's say, $10.5 million. How stable is that, do you think? I mean, are you hearing anything that they could be tinkering with this again, or are they pretty much going to leave this alone for a while?
Well, I'm even going to bring it up to 2014 just to let you know that now the exemption is $5,340,000 per person, and the top rate is 40%. As far as I know, there's no attempt at all to change the exemption. It's a permanent exemption unless, you know, they change the law, but I have heard nothing about a possible change in the law. And the exemption is going up with inflation, so that is why it has increased from $5.25 million. Now, there's something called the President's White Paper, I believe it's called, and that is the administration's wish list. It doesn't come into being just because it's a wish list, but on the wish list is a reversion back to the $3.5 million estate tax exemption and the continuance of what we have now is a portability election that can be made. It's a mouthful, but basically between spouses, you can leave your exemption to your spouse. That's why it's portable, so that the spouse has two exemptions at their death. Portability is still in the white paper to continue, but they would like the exemption to be decreased. So that's the only news that I have, and it's not really any news. It's kind of just a wish list.
A final couple of questions, if I may. Let's say I'm retired or I'm married. I've come into you. I've done my estate plan. I got a will. I have a trust. Okay, so let's say that I saw you, I don't know, January 1st, year 2010. Since I saw you, Roberta, I bought another piece of property. My estate has grown in size because of the bull market that we've seen in stocks. How often should you update? Because a lot of people think, okay, I did the estate plan. I did that a couple of years ago. And they may not be thinking when they buy another piece of property, or maybe their assets have increased as the stock market has gone up over the last 3 or 4 years, or maybe real estate has come back, that they may be subject to estate taxes, number one. Number two, they may be holding title to property, or maybe they moved and their property titling, or maybe they bought an insurance policy, is not up to date and compliant with their estate plan.
Right. So I have clients who I call the ultimate estate planners. They are just something. And they keep spreadsheets. You know, how many clients are like this? But they keep spreadsheets and they show everything they own and the approximate value and exactly how they hold title. Is there a designated beneficiary? And they look this over. They keep track of it. And I do what I call a What's New seminar for my clients every year, where we go over everything that really has changed in estate planning or is on the horizon. And they always come every year to my seminars and they say, what about this? What about that? In other words, they're always checking up on what is going on, kind of on an annual basis. So if you wanted to be the ultimate estate planner, even though, you know, this may not be everybody's nature, you would look at it once a year and maybe around tax season. And in fact, people ask me, does my practice have any seasons? And I say, yes, it does. That when people are getting ready to do their income taxes, we have a huge amount of calls. People wanting to review what they've got, what they did in the last year, not because I do their income tax return, but because they're thinking about it. So those are the ultimate estate planners that every year they're looking at it. I would say to an average person, If you look at it every 3 to 5 years, that would be really great. I'm going to tell you, in reality, I have people call me every 10 to 20 years who are not the ultimate estate planners. Right now, there's something that does concern me, and that is that we have our new higher exemption, this $5.34 million exemption, and each spouse has it. That means an estate could be all the way up to almost $11 million, getting close to $11 million, and not have an estate tax problem. Well, we did sophisticated estate planning for individuals. As soon as their estate was over maybe $600,000 10, 20 years ago, because our exemption was so low, and they have kind of complicated trust arrangements that possibly could be simplified now because of the new exemption. If it's not simplified, the surviving spouse may have to keep additional records that they wouldn't have to keep if it was simplified. So we're a little bit kind of on the cusp of maybe a little reverse estate planning, that we're living in a period now where people possibly can simplify their trusts. We thought they had enormous estates before, but now with the new exemption, maybe we don't have to do such sophisticated planning. So a lot of people are asking me, can they simplify their trust?
You know, you bring up a very good point, because I remember for the longest time coming in with Ronald Reagan, where the exemption was $600,000, and it was there for a very long time. Then they began to raise it, recognizing that real estate prices have gone up, stock markets went up, and that we've had inflation in assets and almost all asset categories. And so these trusts were put into place that split into two trusts when one spouse passed away, because you wanted to take advantage of that double exemption to save on estate taxes. But now with $5,340,000 or whatever the number is, you may not need that anymore, is what I hear you saying.
Right. You might not need it for estate tax purposes. Plus, at the first death, the survivor can file an estate tax return and claim their deceased spouse's exemption comes to them. That's portability. So you can kind of grab your spouse's exemption and keep it in addition to your own exemption at the first death. Now, when people come to me and say, oh, I don't need it for tax planning anymore, I say to them, wait a minute. It may be true that you don't need it for tax planning, but I want to go through this checklist of why the bypass or trust B still serves other purposes. And if you tell me that you don't care about those other purposes, then we'll simplify. So we've developed a little bit of a checklist here to go through all the things we need to think about before we throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, I tell you, it's never easy, is it? I mean, it would be nice if we had one law, it was simplified, but life isn't so. Roberta, if our listeners would like to get in contact with you, especially those that live in California, to talk about an estate plan, how could they do so, please?
Well, they can give us a call. It's 858-485-1990. And our website is trustlaw.us. Now we're all digitized. My son joined my practice a year and a half ago, and we are now part of the new generation. My email is robertarobinson@trustlaw.us.
Well, listen, Roberta, thanks so much for joining us on the program and sharing your knowledge with our listeners.
Thank you very much.
You heard a couple things in that interview with Roberta. Property titling does make a difference. So if you're out there and in your mind, you've said, well, I know my will and my trust says this, do yourself a favor, check your assets, how you hold title to your property, who the beneficiaries are on your IRA, who the beneficiaries are on your life insurance policy, because property titling takes precedent over what you say in a will or a trust. So make sure that if you do have an estate plan, all the parts fit together, you don't have any loose ends that could bypass what you originally thought you were going to do with your estate when you passed on. We've run out of time. On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us on this week's Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.